present my work with Bianca Dittrich on the interplay of simplicity constraints and the emergency parameter in discrete quantum gravity. So I'll start by giving a brief introduction and motivation to the work. As one can see from the title, we'll be working in a discrete framework and in the canonical setting. Coming along with that, with such a setup is a constraint analysis. We shall consider second-class constraints and reduce with respect to them in two parts. Finally, I'll conclude and mention some avenues along which we'd like to develop this project further. Next slide, please. So the dynamical system about which we are going to discuss various aspects today is specified by a bivector field X, a connection W, and Lagrange multipliers phi. These are subjected to the Plavansky action. It has three terms. The familiar SO4BF term, the host modification, which is a star BF term, where the star is the Hodge dual on the Lie algebra, and finally, we have the constraint term, imposing the simplicity constraint. The central protagonist today is the coupling constant in front of the Holtz term, the Barbero emergency parameter. Next slide, please. So the Lagrange multiplier is a symmetric traceless tensor. Varying with respect to it imposes the simplicity constraints in their Lagrangian form. That is, the simplicity of the bivectors. Next slide, please. It is well known that for non-zero four volume, there are two sets of solutions. Without Holtz term, these give the so-called topological and gravitational sectors of the theory. On the other hand, including the Holtz term, the sectors become mixed and the distinction between them is blurred. Choosing the second sector of solutions above, we substitute them into the action and arrive at the Einstein-Cartan action in its first order form. Moving to the second order formalism trivializes the Holtz term in the sense that it has no effect on the classical dynamics. But we know that in this it is present in the quantum kinematics of the loop program, so it'll be interesting to see if its significance in the spin foam approach. With that, let's move on to the spin foam approach on the next slide. So what's the basic idea behind the spin foam quantization? We consider a triangulated manifold and discretize the dynamical fields after the fashion of lattice gauge theory. The bivector is a Lie algebra element associated to the triangles F. The connection becomes a parallel transport matrix connecting two reference frames. Since these reference frames are attached to the flat force symmetries in our manifold, the holonomy, or the parallel transport, is labeled by their shared tetrahedron, T. Then we start by quantizing the BF and Holtz terms only. The advantage is that this is well understood, meaning that one has a well-defined measure and a nice action to work with. In fact, the weight in the partition function is in the form of a plane wave, so we can integrate explicitly over x. Next slide, please. Once we do this integration, we find that we get a delta over the momentum, that is the delta over the holonomy, the usual flatness of BF theory. After that, we immediately re-expand in terms of representations of SO4. So you might wonder why we first integrate and then we re-expand immediately. Well, first of all, it allows us to reorganize the amplitude into localized chunks associated to the tetrahedra and four symmetries. Secondly, we can make explicit contact with the boundary state space of quantum BF theory. That is, the representation states can be interpreted as the quantum representation of the bivectors X. And most importantly, with this interpretation, we have a route to impose the simplicity constraint. Next slide, please. So let's remind ourselves of the constraints in their Lagrangian form. On the four symplices of the triangulation, their discrete form comes in three varieties: diagonal simplicity, cross simplicity, and volume simplicity. I'll go into more detail about these later, so I won't talk about them so much now. But what I want us to take away from this slide is that in their Lagrangian form, I can discard the volume simplicity. If I impose the diagonal and cross simplicity on the BF amplitude, I automatically solve the volume constraint. Next slide, please. So I need only be concerned about imposing the diagonal and cross simplicity constraints. But it turns out that the strength with which I impose these constraints is a crucial factor in determining the resulting spin foam model. Now, one appeals to the fact that the first order path integral is very similar to a phase-based path integral. In light of that, it is very well motivated to check the properties of these constraints. That is, with respect to the BF symplectic structure, what are they, first class or second class? It turns out that the diagonal simplicity constraint is our first class, and we impose them strongly. The cross-simplicity constraints for gamma finite turn out to be second class, so we should weaken the constraint imposition. And what is the result of doing... Sorry, next slide, please. And the result of this weakened imposition is the EPRL FK spin foam models, which have a wonderful property that their boundary state space coincides with that of loop quantum gravity restricted to a single graph. Next slide, please. So the point I want us to take away from this is that the immersive parameter plays a non-trivial role in both the spin foam models and the loop models. Next slide. But, as always, there are obviously some remaining questions. Spin foam quantization is not a conventional method of quantization. Of course, that doesn't matter as long as we get gravity in the semi-classical limit. And it is certainly important, irrespective of the particular spin foam model that we have, to develop tools to extract physics from the spin foam formalism. For example, looking for gravitons and cosmological sectors. But we can also work along different lines and check the correspondence, for example, to the Dirac quantization approach. Remember that we appealed to the phase-based path integral approach on the previous slide to decide whether the diagonal and cross-simplicity constraints were first or second class. These constraints, the diagonal and cross-simplicity constraints, arise directly in the Lagrangian. They are primary constraints. Usually, in the phase-based path integral approach, one conducts a full canonical analysis to check if there are any secondary constraints. And if they are second class, then one reduces by them as well. Next slide, please. So with that in mind, let's re-examine the canonical theory. And we find that indeed there are secondary simplicity constraints. And they are second class. The canonical variables for the BF theory are the bivectors on the hypersurface and the pullback of the connection. Explicitly, the simplicity constraints consist of the primary constraints with which we are already familiar, that is the diagonal and cross simplicity constraints, and secondary simplicity constraints, which depend on the bivectors and the connection. Importantly, these form a second class system. Next slide, please. So it has been shown that an explicit reduction with respect to all these constraints results in an immersive parameter-free phase space. Then if we were to continue and proceed to do a formal continuum phase space path integral quantization, one should reduce with respect to these constraints. In light of this, the measure mu on the hypersurface is determined by the symplectic structure on the reduced phase space, and so it is gamma independent. The action on the constraints to hypersurface has also been argued by Alexandrov to be independent of gamma. And so the partition function is ultimately gamma-free. Next slide, please. So the crux of the matter is that we have a dichotomy between continuum canonical reasoning and the spin foam reasoning. Next slide. And what are our aims? Well, what we wish to do is to shed light on this dichotomy by investigating at a halfway house. That is, a canonical investigation on a discrete manifold. And we are going to do this by formulating discrete primary and secondary simplicity constraints. We're going to reduce with respect to these constraints and find the resulting symplectic structure. Next slide. So, now to get on to the next part of the talk. Let's consider a discrete 3D hypersurface. The discrete BF phase-based parameters are, once again, the Lie algebra-valued bivectors on the triangles in the hypersurface and the group-valued parallel transport matrices. Since we're in 3D, these parallel transport between tetrahedra, and so they're attached to the triangles also. From here on, we shall also make explicit use of the decomposition of SO4 into self-dual and anti-self-dual parts. Next slide, please. So, from a discrete form of the action, we acquire the following symplectic structure. The bivector is in essence conjugate to the connection, the holonomies commute, and the bivectors generate the Lie algebra. Next slide, please. We are going to be dealing with a gauge invariant quantities all the time, so let me define a collection of them right here and now. I've tried to remove as many of the definitions as possible, so I'm going to explain them pictorially. So we have the areas, which are attached to the triangles. We'll have 2D dihedral angles, which are angles between the edges of the triangles. We'll have 3D dihedral angles, which are angles between the vectors normal to the faces. And we have 4D dihedral angles, which are the angles between 4D normals to the tetrahedra. But importantly, we must be very careful at this stage, since these quantities are functions of the bivectors and not actually of vectors. It is only on the geometrical phase space that they are truly what I've named them to be here. And this is a number of very important consequences. First off, consider the 2D dihedral angles above. I can construct them from the bivectors in a given tetrahedron. But in the 3D triangulation, another tetrahedron shares that face. So I can construct that angle above using the bivectors from the other tetrahedron. On the BF phase space, there is no guarantee that these angles coincide. It is only on the geometrical phase space that they coincide. Moreover, this non-geometricity also manifests itself in the definition of the 4D dihedral angles. On the BF phase space, with the bivectors, there are actually 3 definitions for this angle. Once again, it is only on the geometrical phase space that these 3 definitions coincide. Next slide, please. So let's now summarize the constraint. We are dealing with a gauge theory, so of course we are going to have a Gauss constraint. It imposes the closure of each tetrahedron. And we have 3 types of simplicity constraint: diagonal, cross, and edge simplicity. These relate areas, 3D, and 4D dihedral angles, respectively. And they have a lovely form. They impose that the self-dual geometry equals the anti-self-dual geometry. But you might ask, where has this edge simplicity come from? Well, let's show that I'm going to show in the next 2 slides that it is exactly the secondary simplicity in a discrete setting. Okay, so next slide, please. What we showed in the first part of each of the 2 papers mentioned here is that these diagonal, cross, and edge simplicity constraints, with them in hand, one can reconstruct consistent tetrad assignments for the edges of the hypersurface and a consistent extrinsic curvature for the triangulation. There is, in small writing at the bottom, a technical point that one needs non-vanishing 3-volume and non-parallel 4D normals for neighboring tetrahedra, but I shall come back to this at the very end. Next slide, please. Moreover, we have constructed a rather direct relation to the familiar reality condition. In time gauge, our bivectors become triad vectors, and the diagonal, cross, and edge simplicity constraints take the following form, where in the second relation, gamma of x is a discrete 3D spin connection constructed from the triad x. We can see that this is really a discretization of the continuum reality conditions, enforcing the reality of the triads and the reality of the connection. We also note that, written in this form, the reality condition on the connection forces an interaction between the self-dual and anti-self-dual sectors, which perhaps wasn't evident in the other way of writing the constraint. And we shall see this cropping up more often later on. Next slide, please. Perhaps at this moment I should ask if there are any questions. Okay, well, I'll carry on then. Okay, so next slide, I think slide 23. Let's get the Gauss constraint.
Sorry? We didn't get any reply.
No. I don't know. Maybe there were no questions. Excuse me. Are we connected? Oh, you're there. You're there. Okay.
No.
I was just thinking.
Yeah, I was.
Imagine
I didn't get an email.
Hello.
We are connected.
Okay, next we can hear you.
Oh, you? Awesome. Great.
I can hear you. I don't know if anyone else can.
Yes, we can.
Thanks a million.
If you want, do you want a question?
Okay. Yep.
Yeah, just since we're pausing here, where in your discrete phase space is the emergency parameter? You probably said, but I missed it.
All right, so it's in the initial symplectic structure. So if we go back to slide 18, and we look at the phase space structure, it's the phase space structure that's on the BF plus Holt term.
Oh, great.
So
okay, thank you.
Okay. Yeah,
so it's just there and nowhere else at this point?
At this point, yes. So, in fact, I should have mentioned that gamma occurs in these relations. Thank you for pointing that out. All right, so back to slide 23. Okay. So we embark on the procedure of solving these constraints. So first we're going to get the Gauss constraints out of the way. They're first class. And we solve them by going to the gauge invariant phase space. This, of course, prevents any time gauge fixing, so we don't use the reality conditions, but rather the gauge invariant form of the simplicity constraints we mentioned earlier. Next slide, please. So we want to find a basis for the gauge invariant phase space. Remember that our initial phase space is SO4BF, essentially. So it naturally splits down the middle into a left-handed sector and a right-handed sector. For each sector, it is easy to find the correct amount of areas and 3D dihedral angles. What I wish to stress here, though, is that in each sector, we only need one of the 4D dihedral angles per triangle. Remember that in the BF phase space, there were three choices. But in fact, once we pick one of them, we can reconstruct all the other gauge invariant quantities. So this truly provides a basis. And next slide, please. More importantly, of course, we also want to find a minimal set of constraints. Once again, there are natural candidates for the diagonal and cross simplicity constraints. Remember that our BF phase space is now basically split into two halves. These are going to relate these two halves. But when it comes to the edge simplicity, we have to be more careful. Indeed, at first, let us pick one edge simplicity per triangle, just as we picked one theta 4D dihedral angle per triangle. What we find is that this does not exhaust the set of simplicity constraints. It manifests itself in the fact that even after imposing this subset of constraints mentioned above, the three 4D dihedral angles in the reduced phase space are related but not identical. This is not the case in a geometrical phase space. The relationship, in fact, between these 4D dihedral angles is as follows. The amount by which they differ is controlled precisely by the 2D dihedral angles. So remember that I said if two tetrahedra share a face, there are two ways to construct the angle between each pair of edges. And a priori, on the BF phase space, these need not coincide. Even in the reduced phase space, when it's reduced by this subset of constraints, they still need not coincide. So we have a nice way of adapting the rest of the simplicity constraints to our reduced phase space. We will get to the geometrical phase space if we impose either these thetas to be the same or these alphas constructed into two tetrahedra to be the same. That is the left-hand side of the equation, forcing it to be zero, or the right-hand side of the equation. Next slide, please. So, to reiterate once again, in the top right-hand corner, is a box with an overcomplete set of simplicity constraints. What I do then is we pick a subset of these constraints, set one. They still have the same form. They relate left-handed sector to the right-handed sector. But this does not exhaust the constraints in the top right-hand box. So I pick more of them and put them into set two. And it turns out that I can rewrite these constraints as relating quantities within a given sector. And in fact, there are actually three equivalent ways of writing down these gluing constraints, this second set of constraints. As I mentioned, they're forcing the definitions of theta for one triangle to be the same, or forcing the alpha constructed in two neighboring tetrahedra to be the same, that is, really forcing the shape of the triangles to be the same. Sorry, we have a question here.
So, in the top right box, it's overcomplete, but then in your set one, you have exactly the same.
No. So the question was, in my top right box, I have an overcomplete set of constraints. But in the set one, I seem to have the same constraints. No. What I mean to say is that in the top right-hand box, I have a set of constraints for every face, every edge, and for all the possible angles I could imagine constructing. In the set one, I really have a much smaller set. I have parameterized my face space with a subset of angles and areas. It's the diagonal, cross, and edge simplicity constraints for exactly those angles, that subset of angles, that I'm putting in the first set. There are many more angles than I'm choosing as my basis. Well, I didn't want to go into the details. I mean, it's involved to decide which ones you choose, but you can prescribe what you want. What is most important is that I choose only one 4D dihedral angle. Okay. So next slide.
I have a question, in fact, here, concerning set two, because, I mean, it seems that set one is the set of constraints you get by doing, you know, some kind of discrete version of loop quantum gravity. And set two is the one when you want to force this phase space to be the same one as the Regé phase space. But, you know, initially they are different. That's the main thing. So, you know, set two is an extra set of constraints that you may or you may not have to impose. So the justification why you impose it is because you want to be, you know, when you say geometrical, you mean piecewise in your geometrical, but that's not what the theory is telling you that it is.
Well, I think that the continuum theory is telling you that you should be geometrical, and we're trying to mimic that in the discrete theory. So, yes, indeed, we are trying to be piecewise linear geometrical. And we see that
piecewise linear geometrical. So you could be geometrical and not piecewise linear geometrical. So I don't think the continuum theory tells you that you have to have set two. You can investigate this additional set of constraints because you're interested to the relationship between loop quantum gravity and Regé gravity, but they might be different.
May I interrupt? So if I may disagree again, what we have is a set of constraints, these gluing and simplicity constraints. We show that these are exactly the reality constraints of loop quantum gravity.
Well,
so we have rewritten them in that form.
I think it's a bit more precise. What you showed is that if you don't define these gluing constraints, there's some kind of ambiguity about what you would call the spin connection. So, you know, it's kind of a convoluted... of course, in the first set...
I mean, this is true. If you don't impose the gluing constraints, then you don't have a geometry in the sense that you don't have a well-defined idea of what a 4D dihedral angle is. You have three a priori different angles. You have no unique way of specifying that angle.
Yeah, I agree. So you don't have a piecewise linear flat geometries, but you know, maybe it's telling you something else, telling you that the phase space of loop quantum gravity is a discrete geometry, but it's not piecewise flat. It's slightly different. So that's another option.
I mean that option should be investigated, right? If it's truly some type of geometry, then we need to know exactly what that is. I don't know what that is.
Yeah. There's a proposal which is this twisted geometry, which needs to be more developed. But mm-hmm.
I agree that twisted geometries have gone in that direction. But I'm still unsure as to what the psi parameter exactly corresponds to, since it is gauge variant.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I'm just saying there might be an opportunity here. It's somehow telling us that the phase space of rigid geometry and is smaller than the phase space of loop quantum gravity, and maybe that's a good thing. That is, the phase space of rigid geometry is not big enough to capture all the dynamics, but you know, the one of loop quantum gravity might be. That's another.
I could come back with and say exactly the same. I could say that perhaps the phase space of loop quantum gravity is too big to capture the degrees of freedom, that all the actual physics gets washed away by including these extra degrees of freedom. It's a point of view. I mean, this is the point of view I'm taking for this talk. So,
okay,
I'm happy to discuss it further. So, no, I mean, I agree that there are motivations to go in both directions. Okay, so let's move to slide 27. So I've dealt with the Gauss constraint. I have split my constraints into two sets. I'm now going to reduce by the first set of constraints. So I compute the Dirac matrix of the constraints, and I'm not going to present the details of that calculation. I just want to comment on what happens when one evaluates the Dirac matrix on the gravitational sector. One can see a very nice thing, that in fact the commutator amongst the simplicity constraints vanishes in the gamma goes to infinity limit, since it scales as 1 on gamma. So in that limit, they form a first-class subalgebra, and we see that, in fact, in that case, one should impose them strongly, and one would arrive at the Barrett-Crane model. Moreover, it appears, and it is true, that in this case, this particular Dirac matrix is not invertible. But that does not mean that we cannot do our analysis. It just means that we cannot split the two subsets of into two subsets of constraints. In fact, if we consider this first subset and the second subset together, the Dirac matrix, even in the gamma goes to infinity limit, is invertible. Next slide, please. So we compute the Dirac brackets. That is also even more painful, but I won't present the details. What we have is just the result that we have computed this reduction for arbitrary triangulation. Next slide, please. And what do we find? We find that gamma is still present in the symplectic structure, and that the phase space is parameterized by areas, 3D, and 4D dihedral angles from one sector only. This is no surprise, since the first subset of constraints is still of the form self-dual equals anti-self-dual, so it should really have the phase space. In essence, our reduced phase space has the following commutation relation. The commutator of two 3D dihedral angles scales with gamma. This is an exact correspondence with loop gravity. On the other hand, we have to do a bit more work for the commutator of the areas and 4D dihedral angles. Gamma is absent on the left-hand side, they're conjugate, but present on the right-hand side. And in fact, we can trace this back to the fact that the holonomy in loop gravity is formed from the Ashtekarber-Barrow connection. In essence, M tilde is the exponential of gamma times theta rather than our holonomy, which is M times theta. So that's why we see an extra gamma coming out here. So ultimately, we see that there is an agreement between our reduced phase space and the phase space of discrete loop gravity. Next slide, please.
A question. And
yes?
what about the bracket between the areas?
Oh, that's zero. The areas commute.
So is it because your surfaces don't intersect? They don't share an edge, for example?
Well, they've commuted from the very beginning, in fact, the areas. The connection is not involved in the definition of the areas. They're really just formed from the bivectors.
In loop quantum gravity, somehow the areas don't commute if the surfaces share some edge. But this is something which we don't enjoy very much. So,
yeah.
So maybe it's better that you don't.
I didn't. I see what you mean. In some sense, I guess they don't cross. I'd have to think about that a bit more. I think it comes down to a matter of how you define your areas. Here in our formalism, we really just take the areas to be functions of the bivectors. Everything is in the frame of reference of the triangle. So, and the areas are the frame of reference of one tetrahedron. So there is no connection in that case. Yeah, I'd have to. I think if we redefined the areas, we would find that they wouldn't commute. All right, moving to the next slide. Slide 30. Okay, so as I said, essentially, we have the SO4 BF base space down to an SU2 BF base space in agreement with the twisted geometries approach. Moreover, our phase space variables are half what we had just one sector. This is clearly not a geometrical phase space since the 3D dihedral angles are still independent. But this is not the case for a geometric configuration. So we see that loop gravity and discrete Kovansky reduced to this point have genuinely larger phase spaces than the geometrical case, that is Regge calculus. So, next slide. So now let's deal with the second set of constraints, the gluing. We can compute this matrix for arbitrary triangulations, but inversion is very tricky. So we'll make a simplification, in fact, to the boundary of an equilateral force implex. Now, that may seem like a drastic simplification, but I can assure you it is still a painful, painful experience to perform this calculation, and it is non-trivial. We computed the Dirac brackets and found that A was conjugate to the 4D dihedral angle, which is now defined unambiguously. Next slide, please. So the results are that the immersive parameter has disappeared from the synthetic structure, and in fact, this is the first implementation of the secondary reality conditions on the connection in a discrete setting. Next slide, please. So, the immersive parameter is gone, and we have reached the Regge phase space, but in the sense that the phis are no longer independent, and the thetas, the 4D dihedral angles, are defined unambiguously. In that sense, if one were to calculate a phase-based path integral, one would have no immersive parameter. So one can ask the question, would one get to a gamma-free spin foam? Next slide, please. So let's generalize we would love to generalize the analysis. For a generic force implex boundary, one can re-express the gluing constraints as in just the following form, killing the independence of the phi. And this gets us down to length Regge calculus. For more generic triangulations, in fact, the gluing constraints are larger. There are the gluing constraints which kill the independence of the phi, but also there are gluing constraints that a conjugate set of gluing constraints, which are constraints amongst the areas and constraints among the 4D dihedral angles. If I just reduce by the constraints imposing removing the independence of the phi, I get to area Regge calculus. If I then impose the remainder of the gluing constraints, I get back down to what I wanted. Length regicalculus. Next slide, please. So let me say some final words about degenerate configurations. As we said earlier, we rewrite the large set of constraints on the left-hand side into two subsets on the right-hand side. But this equivalence is only possible for non-degenerate configurations. So let us take the four simplex, the boundary of a four simplex as an example. If I impose the right-hand side set of conditions, I get down to the 20-dimensional hypersurface of Regge calculus. A priori, the set on the left-hand side, if I forget about non-degeneracy conditions, is satisfied by a 30-dimensional hypersurface. It is only if I take into effect the non-degeneracy conditions, that is, non-degenerate three-volume and non-parallel normals, that I get down to that kills the another 10 degrees of freedom, and I get down to 20. So in some ways, in passing to this rewriting the constraints as set 1 and set 2, I have managed to include the non-degeneracy conditions implicitly. This is nicely mirrored in the configuration space analysis of the four simplex, where it was found where five additional degrees of freedom were found if the 4D volume were 0, and moreover, these extra degrees of freedom can be mapped to the vector geometries or the SU2BF configurations in the work of Barrett, Fairburn, and Hillman. Next slide, please. So we have a somewhat final statement and question. The immersive parameter after our analysis is no longer present after a complete reduction by simplicity and gluing. So the question is, as Alexandrov has often said, should we be looking for gamma 3 spin foam models? And to the final slide, please. We have many things to do. So Slabansky is an irregular constraint system, and it requires more careful analysis. We should, in fact, deal with the degenerate points separately. We would, of course, love to reduce in gate variant observables because we would be able to use the reality conditions explicitly in their discrete form. And this would have a closer connection to the continuum analysis. I mean, the crux is to generalize the reduction of the gluing constraints to arbitrary triangulations. And key to this, in some sense, is to understand the geometrical nature of the extra constraints that arise in the non-four simplex configuration, in the more general triangulation. And most of all, we would love to quantize this model and see if we indeed get a gamma-free spin foam. Thank you very much.
Any questions?
I mean, about the disappearance of the EMIRD parameter, which happens when you go to this Regge phase space. So in the continuum, we know that, you know, if we impose the, you know, strongly the torsion condition, then you know, same thing, the EMIRD parameter disappears. And in some sense, the Regge phase space is, when you call it geometrical, it's somehow it's a metrical, discrete phase space. So, there's a parallel here, which means that, you know, the one where the immediate parameter still matters before you impose these extra sets of constraints, you know, maybe they are parameterizing the fact that you allow the torsion to fluctuate. And we know that, you know, having geometry with discrete torsion, it's very, very complicated there's no good description of discrete geometry with torsion. And this is maybe, you know, what these twisted geometries are. So,
It would be wonderful to show that directly, right? I mean, that is indeed the case. No. I mean, if that is truly that, if the twisted geometries are in fact geometries with torsion, and they're a nice discretization of that, which doesn't really exist, that would be wonderful, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm also interested in geometries without torsion, so...
I mean, the classical equations of motion, yes, but at the difference is really what you do at the quantum level. Do you allow the torsion to fluctuate, or you don't allow the torsion to fluctuate? And that's, you know, kind of the difference.
Yeah, I mean, if these extra configurations are torsion-full configurations, then I guess that is the question, right? But if they're not, I mean, there could be something else right now. I don't know what they... I don't think we really know what they are, right? I think twisted geometries go along the route of showing us what they perhaps are, but it's not definitive yet. I don't understand what they are. Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
Any other questions? So if there are no questions, let us thank the speaker.